Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? Where you going? Can I come too? If I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So crazy. I never get going, baby. Where you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? This is the Russell and Froh podcast, where the scoring's made up and the points don't matter. I am Brett the Man Bun Garofalo. He is Carl the Talent Jackson, and we are here to discuss all things your and our Brooklyn Nets. Today, we're going to focus on predictions. Predictions about, will the Nets make the playoffs? If they do, where will they be seated? What will be the Nets' strategy at the trade deadline? I think we all want to know. Who will win the backup 4 to 5 minutes? Again, a burning question in the minds of all Nets fans, but we're excited to talk about it. And knowing us, I'm sure there will be some additional fun, unexpected topics that come our way. But to start, the section that everybody listens to this podcast for and then turns it off. Carl, how's life?
Playoffs? Brett, don't talk about the playoffs! No, I'm just, I'm excited for basketball season. I'm enjoying the little part of football season where, you and I both root for 1-0 teams. Obviously, as a Jets fan, you're wishing that you had a durable quarterback like Jimmy Garoppolo. But, we can't all be winners. But I do just want to kick things off with a question, Brett, that I asked you earlier over text, but better Ets career.
Oh God.
Aaron Rodgers or Jeremy Lin? Discuss.
Don't do this to me, Carl. Please don't make me do this.
I mean, listen, you got to celebrate the 5 snaps that Aaron Rodgers played Monday night. Of course, 4 of them were from the line of scrimmage. 1 was just the Achilles itself, but you still got to celebrate all of them. And he didn't last long enough to text a picture of his dinghy to, in-game reporter. So better than the last Packers quarterback they signed.
The wound is still fresh, Carl. Let me heal.
Yeah, I'm really coming at this guns blazing.
If I had to choose, it's definitely Jeremy Lin. Jeremy Lin played. He played. He scored points, didn't he? Didn't he score a basket?
Oh, maybe. That's fair. But I don't think the Nets won his debut. And the Jets did win Aaron Rodgers' debut. So
he didn't complete a single pass.
Did you see that video of I can't remember if I sent this to you or I copied it to send to you and Vivek and everybody, but there was like a bar in Wisconsin that was offering is basically like free drinks as long as the Jets lost. And so when Rodgers went down, like the people were cheering and they're like all start running the tabs up and they did the story and then they go back to the reporter live right after the interception return. And he's like, well, everybody's just coming to grips with the fact that they, ran up their bar tabs and now they're going to have to pay him. I thought that was pretty hilarious.
Eat shit, Wisconsin.
It's true. Your cheese sucks. All right, but let's talk a little basketball here.
God, playoff predictions for the Nets. This is either going to be really depressing or really exciting. I can't wait to get into it.
Listen, we already did our Mr. Brightside episode, so we can
it's time to get off the positivity train and board whatever train we're planning to get on next.
Falling for our Crisco'd thighs
remains to be seen. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about Mr. Crisco thighs today as well.
Yeah, he's pretty integral to the whole operation. So I guess where do you want to start? Do you want to start with,
here's what I'm thinking. I'd like to know if you agree with this and if we're attacking this the same way. Do you think that the Nets' ability to make the playoffs is going to come down to these 4 areas? 1, improvements through continuity. 2, if the roster additions give us anything, because they were pretty small. 3, incremental improvements from some of the returning players. And then D, the real wild card, anything that they get from Mr. Crisco Thighs himself, Ben Simmons. Did I miss anything in there?
I think you are correct in terms of assessing how good the Nets will be. I think the other wild card is just like going through the rest of the Eastern Conference. Like, I think it's,
yeah,
it's interesting because it's pretty wide open. I think you can make an argument that all of the top end talent got, I wouldn't say necessarily worse, but like there's been more improvement, I think, in the middle and the bottom of the pack than there has been at the top. The Nets have obviously situated themselves further down the ladder. And so like part of what was a sobering exercise for me was going through kind of the over under win totals and just looking at like where do the Nets sit within that grouping? Because I think before we kind of really researched this episode, I would have told you that I definitely thought the Nets could make the playoffs. And the main reason was kind of to what you alluded to, and we can go back to those categories for a second, but like, it was just that, like, I feel like the Nets are very deep in terms of they can run a legit like 10 NBA player roster and sort of in my mental or 10 NBA player rotation with like guys, you know, fringe contributors that can come in. They should be the type of team that can withstand injuries as a regular season team, I'm thinking, just because of the wing depth and the lineup versatility and things like that. But there's a couple things. There's a couple things that I think are disruptive to that thought process. One is just, I think the league is better. And the idea of like, oh, you have like a solid, like, you know, 12 NBA player rotation is like less meaningful than it was even in like 2019. Like, I just think that is the talent level in the league right now. And so that I kind of have to adjust my prior for that. The other thing, and this was something I listened to Game Theory, Sam Fassini's podcast with Robbie Callen, where they were going through the East over-unders, and Sam was not very supportive of the Nets making the playoffs. The Nets were like, the Nets over-under was at 37.5. That was one of his only ones that he called out as a definite under. He felt like it was several games too high. And his point was, even though I feel like personally the Nets kind of have this depth, this wing depth, he's like, they're so thin in the front court that like, what happens if Nick Claxton gets injured? Like, and I feel like they've got kind of a couple linchpin guys between Claxton and Dinwiddie where like they're so over leveraged on those two guys to provide specific things that they're not really getting anywhere else on the roster that everything can fall apart. So that's a start, and I've got more thoughts too, but like, let me start there and let you reset up your four categories because I completely
went
the other direction.
That's why I asked it. I wanted to check in and see if we were thinking about it the same way. And you're right. I completely left out how the rest of the East has shifted because it has shifted a lot. Like you said, the middle teams improved, and the way that you were talking about the top teams, I don't necessarily feel like they've gotten worse, or at least right now, because there are some moves still to be made there. But I do think that with some of the instability of how some of the players feel before, or instability created by trades, has created a wider range of outcomes for those top teams this season than last season. For example, Celtics, Kristaps Porzingis, he could elevate them and finally get them over the top to a championship, or he could get injured and miss 70 games.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
And then same thing, right? Maybe James Harden ends up staying in Philadelphia because it sounds like nobody wants to trade for him. And you know Daryl Morey is not going to ship him out for a first-round pick and Terrence Mann. That's not going to happen. And even if, and again, Miami was not one of the top teams during the regular season in the East, but we know that they're going to be in there in the playoffs. If they trade for Dame, they're going to be incredibly top-heavy. So one of those players goes down. Who knows what happens to that team? The Bucks. Giannis is talking about leaving the Bucks. Those players are a couple years older. So that top is going to be super interesting. Do I think those teams are going to drop out of the playoffs? No, I don't. But it's going to shake things up a bit.
So let me do this. We'll go back to the Nets stuff for a second. Let me just run through, because I kind of tiered out the East based on over-unders and just kind of my personal thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think walking through that is a little bit eye-opening just in terms of the challenge that sits before the Nets, I think, in terms of making the playoffs. So let me go through that really quick. So sure. I think, and we can quibble kind of at the margins here, but I'll break them up the way that I think makes sense. You've got your top tier, I think, is the Celtics and the Bucks. Celtics, these are DraftKings over-unders. Celtics are at a 54.5 wins over-under. Bucks are at 52.5. I think a tier down from that, you've got the Cavs at 50.5. I think they're close to that top tier potentially, and I think really a lot of room for progression in terms of just players on their roster because they're much younger. And then you've got the Sixers and the Heat, which are both kind of wild cards. I don't necessarily know where to slot them, but I think, you know, even if Harden doesn't play at all, I think with Embiid and Maxey, like you'd have to assume that I would give the Sixers the nod, at least over the Nets, right? And then Miami's kind of even weirder because I feel like they've got a clearer path to getting better through a trade like that. Like the Dame trade, there's not much mystery there in terms of like where he may or may not end up, right? It's pretty much Miami or bust. So there's that clear path. There's also just the fact that the Heat are so good at just restocking and replenishing like their coffers. So like, even though they lost guys like Max Strus and Gabe Vincent, like they're always finding diamonds in the rough to replace that, you know, they're up there too. And then you've got this sort of next twosome of a tier with the Knicks and the Hawks at 43.5, the Hawks at 42.5. I think and just going through that, right? Just off the bat there, that's seven teams. You're already into the play-in with just those seven. So for the Nets to make the playoffs, you're looking at needing at least two of those teams falling out, right? And the Nets to jump in as the sixth. So just, you know, and you can pick teams to do that, right? Like, I think you could easily see the Hawks, you know, maybe falling short. You could easily see one of the Sixers or Heat falling short. I mean, I think especially the Heat, like, with all due respect to like the Heat culture, I mean, they also struggled down the stretch. They struggled to make it out. They didn't make it out of the play-in last regular season. So like, I think there's reason to believe that could happen. But then you get into this glut where the Nets are with the Bulls and the Nets at 37.5, the Raptors at 36.5, the Magic and the Pacers at 35.5. And so it's like, not only do you like the winner of that group, all of those teams being, I think, like close-ish to the Nets. I mean, you can certainly debate head-to-heads on any of them. Like, but if you win that group, then you're still eighth, right? You're still below the other seven teams that I mentioned. So that's where it gets, I think, you know, a little bit difficult. Just looking at, you know, where this breaks down in terms of the playoff race. And then obviously, you know, there's the path in through the play-in, but like, I don't necessarily know that feels super guaranteed either, particularly with this team that seems like it's going to be a higher variance team this season, no matter what. And so kind of like the idea of like, well, you'll have like Kevin Durant to like make it in through the play, and like doesn't really exist the way that it previously had in earlier seasons.
I could even see Charlotte sneaking in there. If they get a full season of LaMelo Ball, I don't want to mention the name Miles Bridges, but he's a good basketball player. And if they get him back for a full season, and they have younger players that are improving too. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're in that group with Charlotte at the end of the year too.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And that was also mentioned. So like, you know, I do think that just looking at the talent level in the East and who's going to be the, you know, who are going to be the easy outs and things like that. Even Washington and Detroit, I think, are interesting and in putting things together in a way that like there really isn't an easy out, right? There's no tanking team there. There's not even a team on the level of like the Spurs or the Blazers where like they're really committing to like super youth movement at this point. The Wizards, I think, are the closest, but like they've got some, yeah, I mean, you know, Tyus Jones is like an NBA player. Yeah. You know, I think they've got some, you know, Jordan Poole, Kuzma, you know, Daniel Gafford, like they've got some guys. So, you know, I think it's going to be a tougher East for a team that's going to be higher variance and struggle, I think, to score consistently in the Nets. Just all things considered, straight out of the box.
Well, yeah, just throwing that out there. One of the easiest ways to tank is to not have a competent caretaker, and that's not Washington, and that's not Detroit. Cade Cunningham is poised for a leap. Tyus Jones has been the most competent backup point guard for the past 4 years. They're going to be competing. They're going to play okay, and those younger guys are going to be set up well. Are they going to win a lot of games? No, there's not a lot of talent outside of those players on those teams, but they're going to be there in games, and they're going to try hard. It's going to be fun. It's going to make for some really fun basketball. I'm not looking at this dismayed. I want these games to be hard for the Nets. And quite frankly, even if we don't make the playoffs, that's not really going to matter to me. I just want to watch some improvements, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're going to have to actually make some predictions. I do want to ask you though. So of those teams that you're saying two of them need to fall out, are you predicting that any of those teams are going to fall out? Or are you just saying that is what has to happen?
I'm saying that's what would have to happen for the Nets to make the playoffs. I think it is likely. I mean, if I'm predicting the Nets like outcome, I think they'll more likely to be in the play-in than the playoffs. Or get to the playoffs through the play-in. But I think, you know, I would think finishing seventh or eighth, is more likely realistic from where they are, unless one of those teams free falls. Like of all those teams that I mentioned, like the ones that I could see like totally imploding, cutting bait, like the most likely to do that are probably, I mean, Toronto, I think is certainly right there. Chicago, I think, could really go south. And I could see a team like Orlando just having like some growing pains as they're trying to kind of put it all together. So I don't necessarily think if it was just about winning that group that they're in, that to me feels much more doable. It's the fact that they have to do that and vault over some of those other teams. I think they could do it. I think they could get over either. I mean, it's easier for me to say it with sort of the field as opposed to like a specific team, but between the Sixers, Heat, Hawks, and Knicks, I could see two of them falling out. But I don't know.
Yeah, even if they do that, the Nets have to elevate, which certainly isn't a given.
Right. So
yeah, I
don't know. What are your thoughts? Where do you think they land?
Okay. So I took a bit of a different approach, and I really like the way that you took a look at it, broke out the individual teams and tried to predict who's going to fall out, who is not going to fall out, what realm do the Nets fall into in terms of tier, in terms of talent. I don't want to give you my prediction just yet, but what I did is I went into some offensive rating, defensive rating stats from last season. And I only looked into last season because it was a bit cumbersome to pull this up. I looked at the Nets defensive rating, offensive rating, net rating, and what that win percentage was after February 9th, which was, of course, D-Day to many Nets fans, or K-Day. Our offensive rating was 113, defensive rating was 114, net rating was negative 1.1. Again, I'll give these numbers context in a second. I know they really mean much just with me rattling them off. The record was 13-15. That's a 46% win percentage. And if you extrapolate that across an entire season, that's 38 wins. Also, combined with that 38 win pace, I think we got the best possible Mikal Bridges performance that we could have hoped for. It's very difficult for me to see him elevating above that this season. He's a really good player, but it's tough for me to see him playing better than that, going up in usage and keeping his efficiency the same. That was awesome. And I think if anything, a major positive for this season would be him continuing that over 82 games instead of over 28 games. So anyway, if I compare those offensive and defensive ratings to the rest of the East and the rest of the West, I averaged this out for just the play-in teams for the East last season. So the Nets were 113.1 offensive rating. The average for the East play-in teams was 113.8. So we're about one behind that. The average for the average defensive rating was 113.2. So that's better than the Nets 114.2. The average record was 50%. The lowest record to get in was 40-42. So that's still two wins above the pace the Nets were playing at, with Mikal Bridges playing like an all-star. So the only saving grace is that the Nets had a better offensive rating than two of the teams, the Heat and the Bulls, and a better defensive rating than the Hawks. So I personally think if you're looking at that, even if you're looking at a bit of the shakeup that the East could have, it's going to be really difficult to win the play-in. And it's going to be difficult to get there too with how a lot of these teams were playing and how the Nets played down the stretch. So that I also did this for the West too, because I wanted to compare. And I did this for the playoff teams that is in, but again, we're about 1 point behind the average play-in team in offensive rating and 1 point behind the average play-in team in defensive rating, looking at last year. So I have a prediction, but I'll let you respond to that first.
Well, I mean, and so I think the obvious counter to that or question or source of optimism, and I thought this when listening to that episode of Game Theory, and I think you can kind of really track it. Like if you listen to somebody that's pessimistic about the Nets and they talk about like who's making an impact and who's starting and stuff like that, you get really far into the conversation before the idea of Ben Simmons comes up. And I think the counter to what you're saying is, I don't remember how many games Ben played, but it was less than five, I think, during that stretch. I think it was, if it was one. I think he played a little bit, right? Like, just like right at the beginning.
A little bit, because I feel like the Nets shut him down for the last 4 weeks.
Something like that. And he was sort of playing, and he was kind of like a shell of himself. So I think that's obviously the wild card. That was the whole Mr. Brightside idea, right? And I think that that's, I mean, as per the definition of stars who can't rest with other stars or whatever, he's the Nets' only one. So I think him returning to form, and I think there's reason enough to believe that he could, or at least return to something. That's a lot to get back. I think that's a pretty impactful difference maker to have. I think that's the difference between having a chance to be a really, really elite defense and having really good defensive players on a defense that doesn't quite hold together. But here's my worry about it. I feel like Simmons coming back. Well, let me start here. One of my sources of optimism for why I thought this team could be good when we were talking about this before is, and this goes back to sort of the roster improvement, like I find this to be like a very diversified portfolio of a roster, right? Like I think there are a lot of guys who could step up, and we'll talk about the front court, like the backup front court options. Like I like that there are multiple guys vying for spots. I like that, you know, Cam Thomas or Dennis Smith Jr. or Lonnie Walker, like I like that sort of idea where there's multiple places where there's sort of three guys for two spots. And that I think A, promotes competition, which gets the best out of, you know, players, and B, like it gives you more options. And it mitigates the risk of like some guy that you brought in sucks. And so you struggle. Part of that is Simmons, right? Like there's not much that he brings that you can't replicate somewhere else. Like they're a good defensive team without him. They've got guys who can guard on ball. They've got some playmaking. They've got some size. The challenge with Simmons, even apart from whether or not you think he's going to come back and be an impactful player, which is its own thing. So like it's a little bit like saying like, if you just ignore all the off court stuff with Kyrie, like big statement there. Even if you give that pass though, I feel like the risk it's a little bit of a compound risk, right? Because for Simmons to succeed on this team with this roster, I think you need a leap from somebody else to enable that. I guess a way to phrase this is like, what value is either like an all-star level Ben Simmons, understanding what his, like, not one that randomly shoots threes, but like all-star level Ben Simmons, or even like a December from last year impact rotation player Ben Simmons on this roster if you don't get a fairly significant offensive progression from Nick Claxton. Because at some point, like, even if Simmons is good, Claxton is probably still better. And if the two of them can't really make it work with them together on the floor, how helpful is it that Simmons is good? And then the only way it sort of is if he's playing with the bench unit. And if he's playing with the bench unit, you still need Bazley or Giles or Watford or somebody to be able to shoot well enough that you can play a four-out lineup around him. So I felt better about it when it was just sort of like any, you know, oh, we just need like three of these like seven guys to pop. But it's like you kind of need Simmons to pop and somebody else to pop as two of those three in order for it to really get you somewhere. Does that make sense?
And that someone else needs to be able to play alongside Simmons, which is the other difficult piece, like you were saying.
Right. Yeah. It has to be a specific type of player. Like you either, what you really need, I mean, really for the high end outcome, like you need Simmons and Claxton to be able to share the floor at the same time. And that includes at least at the bare minimum, Claxton to be able to shoot free throws well enough that they're not just going to get fouled with 13 minutes to go in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
And ideally it includes Claxton being able to do something with the ball in his hands from like the free throw line and the free throw line extended such that like you can warp the geometry of the court enough to have some space. And coupled with that, you also need Simmons to be able to get downhill and not be afraid attacking the basket. So it's like all of a sudden, you know, there's like all these dominoes that could fall, but it's like, actually you need like all of the odds to work. And now it's like you're looking for a straight draw. You're not just looking for like, you know, another club or something like that.
Right. And even if it makes sense to bring Simmons off the bench because he's not back to the level that they thought he would be, or it just doesn't work with Clax and the other starters, this is the emotional component of it. Based on what we've heard from Simmons, is he going to be willing to do that? Because those interviews that he gave made it sound like he was told by the team that he's the starting point guard, and he in his mind believes that he's a starting point guard. Is it better for the Nets to keep pushing that agenda, regardless of how it's affecting the team on the court, and think about moving somebody like Clax or another player that's not playing well alongside him to the bench? So that it's a bit of a tangent, but that's another thing that I'm worried about that I think throws a monkey wrench in this whole thing, because we still are going to have to deal with the egos of folks on this team. And I think if you remove Simmons from the equation, we have a lot of resilient, strong-willed folks on this team, but Ben is not that person, or he hasn't become that person yet. Again, he's still young. We forget how young a lot of these NBA players are. There's still time to humble yourself, take accountability, and be a, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win guy. We just haven't seen that from Simmons yet. We haven't seen him make those improvements. So I do worry about what happens if it goes wrong and we need him to do something different than he's expecting to help the team win. To answer your question from earlier, I looked it up. Ben Simmons played only three games with the post KD Kyrie era Nets. They were all against playoff teams, and the Nets went 1-3. And then he didn't play a game for the rest of the season. So it was less than five.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, yeah. I'm going to go back to the four factors that I mentioned earlier. As a reminder, the Nets played at a 38-win pace without Ben Simmons after February 9th. The average record for play-in teams in the East last year was 40-42. In the West, it was 41-41, so it was right in the middle. 38 win pace versus 40-42 are what you're expecting from continuity, from roster additions, from incremental improvements from continuing players, and anything you expect to get from the wild card Ben Simmons, is that worth 2+ wins in your mind? I'm not asking you to make a prediction. I'm just curious.
I think the Simmons thing is the one that I struggle with nailing down the most, but I think it should be. I think if you get an impactful Ben Simmons, you get December plus Ben Simmons consistently. So somebody that can make a few hook shots, can get some rebounds, can allow you to be, you know, play with size, can be a plus on ball defender, like that should allow them to move forward. You're still going to need, trying to think of like paths to success. I think they're still going to struggle to score late in games for sure. I think the half court offense is going to be garbage. They're going to rely on a lot of like Mikal Bridges shot making. I think they're going to end up being a team where they're going to need the ball to move. They're going to need to hit threes. I think they're going to be 100% like, you're going to be able to tell by the 3-point percentage, like if you don't see the score in the box score, like whether or not they won and lost, like religiously. And I think that they'll end up being a high variance team for that reason. I think, you know, they're going to need to be really good defensively. That's going to need to keep things close. And they're probably going to need to just have their bench blitz other teams. And honestly, like to the point where like maybe they will play guys back with the bench just to increase the advantage that they're getting in those minutes. You're going to have to win the bench minutes by like 6. I think they're also going to need to defensively, they're going to need to turn things over, and they're going to be a team that lives and dies by the ability to generate offense off their defense. I would guess. I'm intrigued to see them try to put that in place. But I do think some of the things you're calling out though, like, are really important. And the continuity piece in terms of like having a full training camp, having a plan with this roster, being able to set a plan with a roster and then go into a season and like actually try to execute it, like that's a kind of a big deal and kind of a big luxury for a team like this that I'm intrigued to see how that works. I think, you know, the ways that they've got a lot of defensive talent, so figuring out ways that they can make the most of that, I think is cool. But again, it's going to come down to like, what lineups can they put out there that can score? Because ultimately, like, I think one of the challenges of trying to be a team that wins through defense in the way that the NBA works is like, at some point, if you're not making shots on the other end, like even the best defenses are going to struggle if everything is starting off of a missed shot. You know, everything's starting off of a rebound. Everything is starting in semi-transition. And so, especially if you're going to shoot your shot die, it's going to be a lot of threes, which I think it probably will be just based on the personnel that they have and based on what we saw from Jacques Vaughn and like especially in the Philly series, like
playoffs.
It seems like, you know, he's math the math out and like that's what it's going to be. So I don't know. I think that could be worth 2 wins to answer your question. I think that is reasonable. I also think they could be like, this isn't going to make any sense, but I think they could be like 2 wins better and win fewer games just because of the relativity of the competition. That was like another thing that was called out on that Game Theory podcast a lot, where they were like, the Pacers were this way and the Knicks were this way, where they were like, I think there are candidates for teams that could be better than they were last season and win the same amount or fewer games because just the rest of the East is better.
I agree with that. The lowest win total from the playoff teams in the East last year was 47. So I have very little hope that the Nets are going to get up into that range. And that's okay. That doesn't mean I'm predicting that they're going to be a bad team. I'm not even predicting a regression for them, but I just cannot see them getting to 47 wins. That would be such a tall order. And what you called out is what I thought is the most important thing for next season, which is the defense. And as you were speaking, I realized we're going to need to keep a really close eye on the Nets half court defense and the Nets transition defense, because transition defense is probably going to look pretty bad. the defense is going to be tired or from missing shots. We're going to miss a lot of shots. If we're taking a lot of threes, rebounds are going to be longer. So folks are going to be able to catch them on the run and get in transition. I think we should judge the Nets by their half court defense, because ideally if they do get a primary creator at some point, then that will solve many of the transition defense woes. So that'll let us know what we have. And also, talking about a primary creator, I also do not see anybody on this team elevating to the point where you're saying, wow, this is a very competent primary offensive engine on a good team. I don't think we have anybody on the team that could do that. And again, that's okay. We have a lot of great players. Like you said, we're more of a mile wide and an inch deep team versus having those, hey, these players are legitimate stars that can make some noise in the playoff and turn your team into a playoff team versus a play-in team that just gets in. So I also agree that those things are worth a couple wins. That being said, I'm still predicting the Nets to be in the play-in range. I'm just going to lay this out here. I think that the Nets will finish 10th. I think they will be in the play-in. I think they will have a chance to compete for a playoff spot. I think that the offense is going to be an abomination. It's going to be really rough. I think we're going to have to really think about things that we want to pick out to enjoy next season, which again is going to be Mikhail really improving in a bunch of areas and see if he can do it across a full season. It looks like Klax has really put the work into jumper. Can that work? Is what we saw from Cam Thomas in the playoffs real in terms of incremental improvements playmaking wise? What happens with Cam Thomas? Do we get anything from Ben Simmons? What is the actual half-court defense look like? These are going to be exciting things to watch, but I don't necessarily feel like those parts sum up to something that's greater than the whole. And I do think it's going to be a bit of a up and down rough season, but I do think the Nets will be in the play-in and they'll have a chance to scrap for the playoffs. And who knows? The team will be about a season and a half in at that point. Vaughn will be a little more than that into a head coaching gig. Maybe he gets seasoned enough to help this team figure it out, get into the playoffs, and make some noise. That's my prediction. Let me know if I'm being too pessimistic.
I don't think so. I have several thoughts. Number one, what we saw from Cam Thomas in the playoffs was not real unless it was sitting on the bench. But you meant Cam Johnson. So
I meant Cam Johnson. Cool. Damn it.
Number two, mile wide and an inch deep, they'll call us Greg Choden. Number three, so going back to your comment around, I don't want to go on like a whole tangent on FIBA either, but like going back to your comment around Mikhail playing about as well as he could. I'll start here and I'll build toward a real question, but I think like kind of what we saw from him in FIBA kind of connects to that picture, right? And I thought he played really well in FIBA. I thought you saw bursts of him being able to be, you know, a scorer who can get unleashed. He just needs to play Italy every game. I think it is, you know, rankings wise and metrics wise, like he was the top player on the team. Obviously Anthony Edwards, maybe the biggest star, but I think you really couldn't be more excited about what you saw from Mikhail Bridges at FIBA than we were. At the same time, I think for me at least, it did do some damage to my illusion of like him turning into Chris Middleton or something, because I just don't necessarily see that in the cards. And what I kept coming back to today, there was a Thinking Basketball episode, I don't know, two or three summers ago, and I very much remember listening to it while mowing my lawn. That was talking about, and I'm not comparing Mikhail to these players or this archetype of player, but I think the idea sort of holds. It was comparing Ray Allen, Reggie Miller, and Klay Thompson as like second option movement shooter scorers. And there was a whole section that Ben Thompson had about, no, Ben, which Ben is it?
Taylor.
Ben Taylor. Ben Thompson is the Stratechery guy. Ben, sorry.
Franklin.
Cam Thompson, John Campson.
Sears catalog.
Greg Choden. There's a whole section that Ben Taylor had about, of those three guys, like, who gave you the most as like a primary ball handler, like a traditional scorer? And the conclusion was Ray Allen was the best at that of those three, but you were far better off as a team not worrying about that because you'd be much better served to have somebody else in that role anyway. And I feel a little bit like that with Cam. Like, I think it's great for his development as a player to extend him as like a primary scorer. I think that will make him better. I think it can probably increase his market value, even though ultimately like where he's going to end up if he's on a championship team is going to be not doing that. And I think part of the goal of having him do it is to be able to pair him with somebody that allows him to not do it. But I do wonder a little bit, like, with that specifically, knowing that it's like, you're not setting him up to fail, mm-hmm. but you're trying to have him learn in a way where like succeeding at the thing that you're asking him to do is in service of kind of rounding out who he is as a player doing other things, or that's better at primarily doing other things. And I guess it makes me wonder a little bit, like, how do you define, or what is a successful outcome for the Nets this season? And where does making the playoffs factor into that or not factor into that for you?
Wonderful question. I can sum it up in one sentence. I'm not here for a good time. I'm here for a long time. I don't give a shit if the Nets make the playoffs this season. I don't care if they make the playoffs next season. Unless, of course, we trade for a star, in which case I will really care because we'll probably go all in with our assets. But let's say the Nets stay the course. What we're doing is we're rounding out Mikhail's game, like you said, in a way that best prepares him to play second banana to another star who can be a primary creator and be somebody that's equipped to take over the game in minutes when that person is out of the game, or take a lot of pressure off of that person because he's no longer just a spot up shooter and a great defender. That's what I view as success. We make all of our players better in a way that sets them up to be complementary players to primary creators, or a primary creator as the infrastructure of a championship team. That's what I'm looking for. Don't care how we finish as long as I see those things happening and we see pieces solidifying as folks that we want around long-term, and the folks that we don't want around long-term are also crystal clear. So then that's can make very decisive moves and start building the roster around that. Additionally, going back to your point about FIBA, I was going to bring this up as well. I think Mikhail was all around the best player on that team. And like you said, a lot of the metrics bore that out. They had him above Anthony Edwards. But I think that was because he was playing next to other stars and creators, which is him in his best role, in his best iteration. And it showed. He was awesome. He was able to make a couple plays off the dribble. He was pulling up for quick threes off the dribble. But he was able to do that because a lot of the attention and the best defenders and the points on other players, like Haliburton, like Edwards, like America's sweetheart, Austin Reeves, like Jalen Brunson. We don't have a player anywhere near the caliber of those four. And it's crazy to say that because one of those four is Austin Reeves on the Nets. And if we had Austin Reeves, I would be so much more bullish on next season because that would slot Mikhail into his natural role on offense. We don't have that. That's fine. I'm not going to be bummed about it. And I do think that the development that Mikhail will go through is going to be best in the long term. But next season, and some of the mistakes that he makes, they're probably going to be painful, and that's okay. As long as we're prepared for it, we should be okay. Does that match how you were thinking about it? And if not, how were you thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Okay. I think it's all about like his development, and I think it's about reclaiming some value for Ben Simmons. And I think like competing for the playoffs and playing in high leverage games that matter is more important than making the playoffs itself. Making the playoffs is like great as a barometer of like how well they did, and it would certainly be exciting to do it, and it's certainly worth rooting for. And they don't have an incentive to tank necessarily, but they also don't necessarily have an incentive to care is the wrong word. They don't have an incentive to like use their assets to ensure that they make the playoffs next year either. And I think that's a crucial thing. And I know, you know, we want to talk a little bit about sort of the trade deadline. And I think that's, it's an interesting factor here, right? Because would the Nets be buyers or sellers at the deadline is something that we talked about. And then we kind of rephrased it to like, will they be holders or folders? Because I think that like there's, I don't know. Like, do you mind if I answer my own question to get started and then you can kind of respond there in terms of like, no, so, I mean, I think they're almost definitely not going to be buyers unless it's facilitating some other deal, right? Like I could see them, you know, if a Dame trade is to go down and like they were to take back Tyler Hero, like I could see that being a route that they would choose to go at the deadline, not because they're actively like going out and seeking that, but because somebody needs to do that. There's an opportunity to, you know, take a second draft guy, have it fall in their lap. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I don't see them being buyers, even if they're competing really hard for the 10 slot and there's somebody out there that would help them. Like, I don't see that happening. I think above all else, they're going to stay out of the luxury tax. Number one, first and foremost, don't see a situation in which they're willing to change that.
Full stop.
Unless they're getting.
Yeah. Unless, hey,
this Kevin Durant back or something. I don't know. Right. Like, so that's thing number one. Thing number two, I would guess in an ideal world, the Nets would be competing for a playoff spot and feel like their depth is so good that they are able to jettison redundant pieces that happen to be on expiring contracts. So they're able to trade Royce O'Neal because they feel like Jalen Wilson or whomever is stepping up in a way that like allows them to not miss a beat while getting rid of him. And staying under the luxury tax. So that's like an interesting variable to me, because that's a really nice case scenario. You get into a much murkier scenario when you're trading Royce O'Neal. It's hurting your team. It's giving somebody else an opportunity to step up. And so it's worth doing it, even though it pulls you back from making the playoffs. There's all kinds of different psychological components of that in terms of what message does it send to the guys in your locker room, et cetera, et cetera. But Royce is on expiring. Dinwiddie's on expiring. It'll be interesting to see what happens with those guys down the stretch. It'll be interesting to see if there is a decision to try to get Tariq Whitehead playing time or potentially Noah Clowney. That could be a route that would make sense for the long-term development of this team at that juncture. But I don't know. I think the likeliest scenario is that they hold. I think the likeliest scenario is that they hold in a way that doesn't allow them to maximize their assets. I think they're set up with wing depth where I would guess that Royce O'Neal will go and Dinwiddie will stay. That would be my prediction for the deadline, and we'll see what they get back.
I am interested to see how much Spencer Dinwiddie's Game 7 performance against the Phoenix Suns carries weight across the league, because I could see somebody coming in and throwing a couple picks to get him, especially if they feel like they're one secondary creator away from taking pressure off of their star to go deep into the playoffs. But that is a much less likely scenario than the lower price that folks will have to pay to get Royce O'Neal, which is probably a single first round pick. And unfortunately, that first round pick will likely come with considerations or some sort of top 10 protected, top 15 protected, who knows. But hell, I'd trade him for that.
That's less than they gave up to get him. So
yeah,
I don't think that's, I wouldn't kick that out of the bed for getting crumbs in it.
I don't see a way where the Nets are going to be buyers. I mean, they would have to truly believe that those moves got them into championship contention, or the move would have to keep them under the luxury tax, and they would have to be bringing back a player that they believed was going to be the, not necessarily championship core, but the infrastructure around that championship core in the future.
Well, I mean, and that's why I'm saying, like, facilitating a trade, like a Dame trade, by taking back Tyler Hero and like giving up Dinwiddie and Royce, for instance, where Royce could, like, both of those guys could get routed to, I mean, you know, and all of a sudden this is like a 17 team trade, and so it's impossible, but like
your favorite,
I you know, that to me is a route where they're not buyers per se, because they're not like trying to go find somebody to fill a need, but they are opportunistically like grabbing talent in a way that like makes sense for them long term. Even if Hero's not part of their next championship core, the fact that like he is then somebody that might have a higher or equal value on the trade market to Dinwiddie, but be under contract for longer, but not necessarily push them over the luxury tax, like that to me is just smart asset management, and it helps you, probably helps you more than it hurts you on the floor this season, even though it's a 2-for-1 trade. So like, and particularly if you could convert, like if Jalen Wilson is playing well enough where you could convert him to a full contract and get him off the two way or something like that. Like that to me would be like a bang, bang, like win-win, like not necessarily something we're going out shopping for, but we happen to see it and it was on sale and we're going to need it at some point. So we might as well just pull the trigger.
Yeah, I'm with you. If the Nets are focused on anything but the big picture this season, I'm going to be concerned. Let me put it that way. And I really like that trade that you set up. If we don't have to give up an asset or a non-player asset to get Tyler Hero, I am all for it. If we can give up Dinwiddie and Royce O'Neal to take back Tyler Hero, let's do it. I'm there. I really don't want to give up a first-round pick to bring back a player that the Heat don't want and the Blazers don't want. Like, that's why we would be taking Tyler Hero.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind throwing, like,
it's not that they don't want him. It's that they don't want to trade anybody else. And,
well, they don't necessarily, like, have anybody. I mean, like, that, like, part of it is just positionally he's, like, redundant to Lillard. And so that, I don't know. I think he'd be more valuable to the Nets than he would be to the Heat in that scenario.
Yes, absolutely.
And I would toss in a pick for it. I wouldn't toss in a ton of picks, but like that to me gets me closer to landing a star. It gets me closer. It makes me better on the floor, most likely. Like, it fills a need that I hadn't previously had filled as well. I think, like, better than we would have had with those two guys. So I'd consider throwing in a first for that, for sure. But it just depends. It depends on a lot of different factors, but like that to me is like one where you're still getting enough of a bargain, like, that it could make sense. You're facilitating something for, you know, somebody else, but it's the right long-term play. He's going to have more trade value this offseason than Dinwiddie would as a free agent.
Point. I have never thought through the future trade value of the asset that we were trading for, component of Tyler Hero. I completely agree with you that he makes the team infinitely more watchable. He fills a creation and off the dribble 3-point shooting hole that we just don't have right now. But my thought was always, that's just going to be a short-term sugar high for Nets fans to make the team a bit more watchable, because the offense is going to be rough, even with a resurgent Simmons next season. But now with the cap going up, with Tyler Hero locked in under contract, a lot of folks were saying that's going to be almost like an albatross, a tough to trade contract. But I don't see that. And I do think that we might be able to get more value, or the team that he's traded for might be able to get more in a trade for him in the future than they have to give up for him now, because he's being used as flotsam or jetsam in that Blazers Heat trade. So that's interesting. That makes me a little bit higher on trading for Hero than I was, because at first I was opposed to it, thinking, why are we giving up a first round pick for aesthetics?
I also think it's like, I don't know that aesthetics is, I get where you're coming from. Working through some analogies in my head, like I get where you're coming from, but I also think like there's an additional benefit just of like it doesn't get you all the way there on its own. That's for certain. Whereas like it's possible, like if you traded for Donovan Mitchell, like it would, yes. But at the same time, like it opens things up where you could pair like a different person with him that could potentially make things work. Like if you could do Hero at a single draft pick cost, but then get off Simmons money and sign Pascal Siakam, for instance, mm-hmm. where like Siakam is clearly an upgrade over Simmons because he gives you shot creation, while also bolstering the defense. And like and now games. You're, well, yeah, yes. Sweater collection, downgrade. Everything else, upgrade. Like now you're looking at three all defense level guys, Cam Johnson on the court with Tyler Hero protecting him. Mm-hmm. Hero becomes probably your third best player, but second best offensive player, maybe your best offensive player, depending on how you look at it. Like I feel like there's just more. There's more,
most important, I would say, most important offensive player, even yourself.
Yeah, best. It gives you, it just gives you more that you can do, kind of offensively, or just like lineup construction wise. I feel like from starting with him, and you can also move him in a deal in a way that's like he's got some value and like a decent salary number. So like, I don't know. I think it would be worth hopping in at the right price. And I don't think that right price is like nothing. Mm-hmm. But again, like I don't see them buying at the, I don't see them buying like a Royce O'Neal equivalent type, you know, guy. I don't see them getting Gary Trent. Particularly since he's already on the roster as Trent and Wanford, just for that type of marginal upgrade at the deadline. I think the only way that they buy is like if there's a long-term play that just happens to fall into their lap right then. Basically, a deal that they would make in the offseason is available then and only then, or for a better price then. That's when they would do it.
Well, okay. So, yeah, I think this is the dark horse question then, because I agree with what you're saying about Hero, and I've come more over to your side on that. So, touche. What happens with Klax? Because I don't know how the Nets feel about re-signing him or how they feel about the price it's going to take to re-sign him. I guarantee you the Nets would love to have him back, but he's going to be expensive. The Nets don't want to go into the salary cap. There's a lot of other players on this roster that they're going to have to pay eventually. If this goes into the offseason, maybe there's a sign-in trade where you get very little out of that. Whereas if you trade him at the deadline, there could be not significant, but not insignificant value that you get back. He's worth at least a first-round pick and a good first-round pick. I don't think they want to trade Klax. I don't necessarily think they're going to trade him at the deadline, but it's a possibility.
I think it definitely is. I mean, I would foreclose on them being buyers in a lot of ways much earlier than I would in them being sellers in almost any way. I think all of that's on the table. I doubt they'd trade Mikal Bridges at the deadline, but like I think that's likelier than them trading for an upgrade.
Yeah, it's a fair way to look at it.
Like, at the deadline, unless it is part of something bigger, right? And so, like, I mean, one scenario is, like, could they trade Claxton to bring back a better, like, a Siakam-type player? Like, potentially, I suppose. I don't know if that deal makes any sense, and I don't know what the numbers, like, how you'd work the numbers out, and there's, like, a lot of stuff there, but, like, I could definitely see them. And I think they'll have broached the subject with his representation. Like, I think they'll understand what he's looking for. I think they'll understand what the market will bear. Like, in my view, like, I think it would just make more sense to hold on to him, both as like an organizational development story and somebody that they've poured stuff into, and just an ascending player that like fits timeline wise with what they're trying to put together. But, and I think like also like looking at the Cam Johnson deal too, like if you're signing your own guy, like I think you have a little bit more control over setting the contract up in a way that like would ensure that it has some trade value in the future. So I don't think it will happen, but I definitely wouldn't put it past them. And I definitely think that there's a point at which like it would be the right move, particularly if you're just not on the same page with his representation over a number. I think the likeliest scenario where that would come into play is like one where he flashes some potential, but he's kind of inconsistent and he doesn't play very well. And like, you know, things just aren't fully working out.
Nets aren't playing well either. I think the Nets would really not have to be playing well for the Clax trade to be on the table. Hey,
I think that's right. And I think if their defense, I mean, you know, like I think their defense struggling, them struggling with rebounding, their defense struggling because they're always playing in transition, like him not getting the sort of pub or notoriety that he is capable of getting because he's playing on sort of a middling team, even if he's holding down the fort as a defender, like, you know, I could certainly see, you know, or if he's trying to do too much on offense and just sucking at it, I could definitely see that being a scenario where like they're just too far apart and, you know, he wants to go somewhere else.
I could too. And it's sad to think about it, but there's a couple scenarios where the Nets could do that and make the team better long term, which would suck because I'd rather root for Clax for the next 3 to 5 years. But I get it if that happens.
I'd be intrigued as to like what kind of market he'd have in that scenario.
I was just going through that in my head. I was trying to think about what teams would be buyers for Clax. And you would assume that it's a team that feels like he is the piece to put them over the hump or bolster some playoff depth. But I don't know. He's still young enough that a rebuilding team or a younger team might view him as a potential piece and be willing to give up something for him. Like, hey, we can keep going through this yearly gauntlet of going through the draft and hope that we pick up some players, or we can take this first rounder, chuck it to the Nets and grab a player that we know is worth more than the value of a first rounder. So I think there's a couple avenues there, but I think it's more likely that he's going to be looked at as a potential piece. Like, I honestly, I think the Mavericks would probably benefit from having him because they need more defense. And he would play great next to Luka. And we already know he can play great next to Kyrie. I don't know what the Mavericks have to give up, but
I wonder if there's like a lot, like a giving Lively back, knowing that the Nets are interested in him.
Interesting.
He's got like, you know, more upside, but it's probably farther off. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense either, but, and there's
it resets the timeline.
Salary stuff to figure out. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I really love the idea of him getting paired with like a stretch center in some way, whether that's
Cleveland.
Or like Oklahoma City with like Holmgren or
oh, he'd be great there.
You know, something like that could be kind of interesting. I'd be intrigued to what his market's going to be like. I guess the other thing is like, if the Nets feel like he's going to have less of a market in the off season than he thinks he's going to have, that could also be a source of like where they're not willing to go all in with an offer and, you know, making him wait. And so, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. That's going to be a fascinating situation to watch play out, but I am also excited to watch Nick Claxton in a contract year.
I really think like Simmons is obviously the most elasticity in terms of what this roster is going to be, but I think Claxton is second and I don't think it's particularly close. I agree with you that like I don't think there's that much more of a leap for Mikhail to make. It's more about like consistently being able to do it over the course of time. I think there's like some possibility with like Dennis Smith Jr. or guys like in more limited roles, but like Claxton is the one guy where like I think he's going to be on the floor all the time. His ability to like, I don't think he has to be. I think the strides he can make to be competent on offense and like participate in an offense that is decent, while being able to stay on the floor as a defender are huge. I think his ability to play like within a like a drop scheme to allow the Nets to really like take advantage of the length that they have with perimeter defenders is enormous. So I think there's just a lot there. And there's just, it's just, it's attainable stuff where like, I'm not like it, like it's a big leap and it's a lot of hard work and I'm not suggesting that it's like stuff he should do necessarily. But it's like, it's attainable to think that like he could add a little bit of an elbow jumper to the point where like he can then face up from that spot and like move around. It's attainable to think that like he can add a little bit more playmaking out of the short roll and like even from the top of the key to a point where like he and like a Ben Simmons could coexist. Like these things are reasonable to think that he could do, particularly given that we've seen him shoot threes. It's reasonable to think that like maybe he could can the occasional corner three. Like I think and those like completely warp the court for him on offense. So we'll see. I'm very excited. I'm all in.
No, I am too. And because he showed the ability to incrementally improve. He put on weight.
Totally.
He improved his free throw percentage during the season. He has so much more touch around the basket now. He's got those little turnaround bank shots. He can dribble a little bit. I mean, those things aren't insignificant. I've been really impressed by him.
And if you take out really the 1 year that, which sucked because it was sort of like the second point in the line, was like the one that was out of sync with him. And that was the year, it was the year after the Bucks series when he came back and he had like mono or whatever he had. And I don't think they disclosed it, but it seemed like mono. Makes sense.
Mono good.
Handsome fellow going out, making out with everybody, getting diseases. And his conditioning was just shot. And like, it like sort of seemed like what the fuck did he do all off season? Well, the answer is got mono. That was the one area where it was like, oh, like he's taking a major step back and we thought he was going to progress. And I was like, well, no, he like had an illness. Like that's a different situation. So I'm really excited to see what he can do. He's definitely like shown to be a worker. Like he cares. Like, I think it's a great opportunity for him to get a payday as like a second round pick. Like, I don't know. I hope he stays. I think that would be, I think it'd be fun.
All right. Thanks for indulging me with the Clax conversation. I can't let a podcast go by without talking about him. So I needed to find a way to sneak him in there.
No.
I think the deadline was a good opportunity to discuss him.
No, I think it's actually, it's a fascinating deadline thing. And it's one that like, I wasn't thinking of with the way that we framed it up originally, but like, I think it's arguably like a more pivotal move for them.
I think because that's the thing that tips the Nets' hand the most.
At the end of the day, like whether or not they get the 25th pick for like Royce O'Neal is like, I think it's a bigger thing to complain about than it is to like actually have. I mean, that could be a great pick. Like that's awesome, but
it's more just another first rounder to throw in a trade. I don't think the Nets are actually planning to make that pick if they trade wrong.
Well, unless, I mean, if they get it for this draft, like they may or may not.
That's a good point. You know, agree. Yeah,
have a choice with it, but
yeah. Yep. No, you're right.
But I agree with your thinking too. Like that would be more valuable, right? Like if it's like a future first where they can like include it in a trade, like that's one thing. If it's, you know, they're going to take some dickhead with it, like whatever. So speaking of ways that we can support Nick Claxton, let's talk about who's backing him up. And let me start with a hot take question for you, Brett. Is this race that we're talking about, is this three guys vying for two slots or four guys vying for three slots on the roster? And here's who they are. It's obviously Darius Bazley, Harry Giles and Trendon Watford. But is it Darius Baisley, Harry Giles, Trendon Watford, and De'Ron Sharp for four roster spots? Discuss.
Shit. I think you got to throw De'Ron in there. I think you're right. I think the only reason that he got minutes last season is because A, the Nets had no other choice, and B, it was clear that the Nets had pivoted to more of a developmental phase. He did get some burn in the playoffs, which was nice, but who else was going to get that backup Clacks burn?
Yeah, he got burned until he got extinguished in game one.
It was rough. So I think yes. And I think there's strong potential that some of these players fit the scheme that Jacques Vaughn wants to run and fit the vision that the Nets have about having all these really tall, really long athletes on the team. And that also tells me a little bit of what we were talking about earlier. They know that they're going to have to turn the other teams over to have some semblance of a competent offense. The more folks you can get out there that have really long arms and have switchability, the more chance you have to actually turn the ball over and get in those passing lanes. So yes, I would say 1,000% De'Ron's going to be competing, and I wouldn't be surprised if he lost.
I think he's competing. I would be a little surprised if he lost for sort of two reasons. One just being the contract situation. But that's not the end of the world. But two, he's the most different of the four guys. And I think that he's, whether or not he can stick on the floor is like a different proposition, but he's at least good at one thing that the Nets are really bad at. Like, he's a very good rebounder. He's a very good offensive rebounder. And like, I wonder a little bit if there's just some value in having him on the roster for games when you play Jonas Valanciunas or Steven Adams or like one of those types of centers, where now all of a sudden the limitations that he has aren't as big of a deal, and the strength that he has is maybe not enough to overcome like playing that type of player, but like at least it mitigates it somewhat, and it prevents like other teams from just going full like Tristan Thompson mode on you, where they're going to just crash the offensive glass because they know that you don't have a prayer there. That would be my one, that's what De'Ron has going for him. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that as a third year big, he puts together a bit of a leap this year. I think that's kind of like a familiar trajectory that we've seen, particularly with big men. And it doesn't, and again, not, that doesn't mean he's starting. It doesn't mean he's like pushing Claxton for playing time, but like, I think as a situational backup, and particularly if you're going to pair him with one of these other guys, who's more of a 4-5 tweener that, can kind of stretch the floor, which I think makes a ton of sense with Ben Simmons. Like, don't get me wrong, but like, I think that there are lineup constructions where like maybe it doesn't hurt to have De'Ron Sharp coming off the bench.
I agree. I agree because the Nets don't have any other option to come and bang around with a Valanciunas type. And there are enough teams with that type of player out there that I think the Nets have to have one of those folks on their roster. Not that I think the other players are getting injured guarding them, but it's going to look like Dikembe Mutombo trying to guard Shaq, except it's a shorter Dikembe Mutombo.
Yeah, and I think it's different to have a weakness where you have somebody on the bench, and part of the benefit of exploiting that weakness is like that you get them to put a worse player in, but at least they can do something about it. Yeah. As opposed to exploiting a weakness where there is literally nothing that the other team can do about it. And like, it just is what it is. So
fair.
So I think there's some value there.
So I think to me, it sounds like whether he's the best player of the four or not, you feel like he has the safest spot because of the unique value that he brings to this particular roster.
Yeah. Safest in the sense that I think he is likeliest to be in the top three.
Okay.
Probably not the number one guy in any circumstance. I don't think he has the highest ceiling, but I think that like, if you're taking three of those four, it doesn't necessarily make sense to me to have the three be Baisley, Watford, and Giles. I think there's just too much kind of redundancy there to push Dayron out, given that he's at least a different look. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And then I have, like I said, I watched, seen stats, I'm familiar with the guys, but like I really just watched about a 90-second segment of each of their highlight videos before this. And I was surprised at how strong of a preference I came out with for one of the other three.
Strong preference as well, but I would love to hear what yours is.
Should we just say who our preference is on three?
Yeah, I'm down with that.
One, two, three.
Trent Wofford.
Darius Bazley. Oh,
let's go.
All right. Mine is Bazley by far. He was the only one that like looked like he was actually hitting outside shots and like comfortable hitting outside shots and like running offensive sets where he was stretching the floor in any way. And I think he's the best defender of the three. So that to me seems like a fairly obvious choice, but I'm interested to hear why you chose Wofford.
So I see what you're saying. And I've said this before, Darius Bazley gives me a bit of Wes Johnson vibes where he looks the part more than he plays the part. I do think he's an impactful defender. Here's the case against him. He got a lot of minutes in OKC. They're a developmental team. If they saw something in him, they would have kept him around. And the reason that they didn't is he fell out of favor in Dignall's system. I looked a lot into his system and why he fell out of favor. Just a couple articles. Dignall came in and implemented a system that was about quick decision-making and sharing the ball. And the second that happened, Darius Bazley's playing time went down and down and down. And then he was eventually traded to Phoenix, where he also continued not to get any playing time. So what I worry about there, outside of being a versatile defender, which I agree that he is, he can guard multiple positions, he's super long, he can be really disruptive when he's on ball and doesn't have a lot to think about. And I think that there's significant value there. So I could see him being the top choice. He's not my bottom choice by any means, but he seems more like a theoretical 3-and-D player, more of just a D player that can't be cerebral enough to play in a high performing offensive system. So that's why I didn't have him at the top.
Counterpoint.
Okay, let's go.
Which high performing offensive system is he being inserted into? Because I thought he was on the Brooklyn Nets.
if we want to have any chance of playing good offense.
Well, no, but I mean, like I feel like there's something to be said based on my reason for sort of trepidation with Simmons earlier. Like, I think there's something to be said for a guy who's his size who can, you know, competently enough play switch center defensively. If all he can do is stand in the, I mean, you don't have to be a brain genius to stand in the fucking corner and shoot threes. Like if he can do that and that opens things up for Simmons to play and just creates additional combinations for him to, for the Nets to gain value from Simmons being on the floor. Like, I feel like that is a condition that might multiply his value more so than just what you'd see like on a different roster.
Well, let me take a step back then. So here's the way that I was thinking about this whole thing. And now I'm going to reference a Vecini pod. This is just a shout out to Sam Vecini, the whole pod, but there was a good Vecini Spinella pod. I want to say it was about a month ago when they were talking about how their prospect evaluation process has changed over the years, specifically over the past 5 years. And one of the things that Vecini said is his assessment or judgment of intelligence, processing, and character skyrocketed up his list in terms of where he ranked certain players before the draft. I have no idea what Darius Bazley's character is like, so in no way, shape, or form am I attacking that. But there are a couple of things that were red flags to me. One, the Dignall system thing that was based on being a cerebral, smart, quick decision-making basketball player. And then two, I read a lot of things about he needing to gain weight since he came into the NBA and it not really happening. And those type of things worry me a little bit. I realize I sound like one of the old school guys in Moneyball right now, but I was trying to read between the tea leaves about how this guy fell out of favor, why he didn't get burned in Phoenix. And I totally get that he's a second draft guy and that the Nets could make the most of him. And that could definitely happen. But I also see the red flags there and why two teams have now punted on this guy who, if you watch the tape, you're right. Incredible defender. Nobody's disputing that. But if you put him in a system, how good is he? And then how good can he be outside of that? So I'm just not sure how much more upside is there. Anyway, that's the case against. I realize I sound like I'm bashing the guy, but that's just why I didn't make him my number one.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I guess my counter would just be, I don't know if saying that he has like the highest, I don't know if we should care about the floor. Like, I don't know. I think there's something to the idea of bringing somebody in who can unlock things for the rest of the guys on the floor. Even if the ceiling is lower than it would be with other guys, but I'm excited to hear about Watford. So tell me more about him and why you think he's your number one.
I absolutely love this guy. So first and foremost, and why I think he's going to be, it's tough because Bayes has a contract, Watford doesn't, and that does typically mean a lot.
I think they're all three non-guaranteed, right?
Oh, they are. They are all non-guaranteed.
Pretty sure. Bayes might have like the most. Are there maybe Bayes's partial, and the other two are non. Mm. But they also just might be all non-guaranteed. I'm not sure.
I'll have to look that up about Bayes. I know that Giles and Wofford are definitely not guaranteed.
Basically definitely does not have a fully guaranteed deal. That I 100%
am okay. Sure. Okay. Well, that makes me feel a little bit better about this pick then. So one thing that I found out is when Wofford was dropping on draft night and ended up not getting drafted, the Nets actually called him and his representation at the end of the draft and offered him a two-way contract. And there were two spots left and he said no and didn't take it because he was hoping that one of the teams at the end would grab him. So the Nets have been interested in Watford since before he was in the NBA, which I found out, which I thought was pretty cool. And now they're finally getting a shot at him on a really cheap, unguaranteed contract.
Did they take somebody out? Like they offered him a two-way with like two spots left in the draft and he said no and then was not available. Two picks later.
Yeah.
So they took Jalen Hands.
Oh God. I wonder if that draft is when we took Jalen Hands. That was the Josiah special draft.
Yeah, it was like Josiah, yeah. like watching him play lacrosse or anything.
Yeah. Jalen Hands, he spoke to some kids at my lacrosse camp. We got a draft.
Yeah.
And also you were talking about Darren Sharp being unique. I think Watford is too. I think he can put the ball in the basket. He can't shoot threes, but he's got a little floater. He's a hustle player, and he can just make weird shots from weird places, which we're not really going to have on the rest of the team. And I just think that's what we need. We need a player that has a couple shots that he feels comfortable taking, that he's confident taking, put the ball in the bucket, play bench minutes, go back and sit on the bench. That's all we need. Just stem the tide, keep it moving forward, really hustle a lot, keep the energy going, be a great locker room guy. That's all I want out of this position. This is a backup player. We're not going to get somebody that's going to be a future all-star. I want somebody that can keep the lights on, that's going to keep the team motivated. And he's got a great story behind that too. But that's also talking more like an old school Moneyball guy.
I think so. And I think him being able to be a little bit more of an offensive focused guy from a big spot is positive as well. And I think that works in terms of being unique too. I mean, I would pick both those guys over Giles. I mean, that would be my three right there would be Sharp, same. Watford and Bazley. And I think that are complimentary. They give you different things. And it makes sense. Giles, yeah, Giles, I think is like
a
fun name. And I would love, I know he's had some like injury history and stuff like that. And, maybe he's put it together. I think it's great that they're taking a look at him. Makes sense for him, coming into camp. Maybe you can loan Clowney to Barcelona or something for the year and give Giles his roster spot. I don't expect him to play at all. Like, I'm not sure. Clowney and Cam.
Yeah, if he's playing, something's gone wrong.
Clowney and Cam Thomas can have a cage match for my most despised.
God, that Clowney pick.
Irrationally despised player.
Leonard Miller was right there.
Oh, my God. Ugh, don't even get me started.
And he's playing well.
He's so good in Summer League. But, yeah, I don't know. That would be my two. Giles, like, seems fine. I mean, I don't know. Like, he seems like not quite as good offensively as Watford, not quite as good defensively as Baisley. Like, more limited in terms of what he can do on offense. Doesn't really shoot and stretch the floor. Like,
his jumper's slow too.
He
looked slow. His jumper's slow. This dude had multiple ACL tears before college, and then two season-ending injuries in the NBA. I just feel bad for him. But
yeah,
I just don't see it at this point. It's like he's trying to get back to the player that he was, and he's just not that person anymore.
Right. And the guy that he even like was like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think there's enough limitations in that game anyway. And then for somebody to sort of like lose their athleticism but not have a ton of skill, it's hard to see a path.
Anyway, here's my prediction now that we're talking through this. I think you're right. I think Baze looks the part. I think that his tape tends to pop a little bit more. I think that the Nets start the season giving Baze the most burn. But then throughout the season, Watford's hustle, his energy, et cetera, leads to him getting more minutes eventually down the stretch. That's what I'm thinking. Could easily be wrong.
I think that makes sense. I also think like it's a scenario where, you know, maybe Baisley starts as your backup center nominally.
That's interesting.
And then maybe you do trade Royce O'Neal, and like Watford is like a guy that could fill in as like a power forward in those lineups. Figuring that the bench would be Dennis Smith Jr., Lonnie Walker, Royce, DFS, Baisley to start. And then, you know, eventually Watford could like work his way in. It could also be something where matchup by matchup, they rotate that fifth spot on the bench. I'm not sure, but
man, Baisley, a lot of flexibility there. That's a fun small ball center though, Baisley.
I think so. And like, then you can play Ben Simmons back there. And if you're playing like Ben Simmons, Finney Smith and Baisley, like, no, you don't have a real center out there, but like, you're not doing the thing where you're pretending that Ben Simmons is, but all he's also guarding the point guard and playing point guard on offense. And like, why is he a center? Like, doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's some options there.
Yeah. Baisley's taller than Trenton. He's an inch taller. I didn't realize that. That's
yeah. And his wingspan is, he's like a 7 foot wingspan guy, right?
His wingspan is nuts. Yeah. He's one of those ultimate tool guys like Anthony Randolph.
Yeah.
I didn't listen. He's better than Anthony Randolph, but it just reminded me of like, oh my God, look at this guy's measurements. It's
Albatross out there. Right. But you know, I think that at the very least, like that just tells me like he can play bigger than his height. And like, I think like, you know, to our point, like there's something tantalizing about like, he could also potentially play next to Claxton offensively. Like that's kind of cool. Maybe there's a way, you know, like if you want to all switch everything, like that's an interesting way to go about it. As well, like if you throw Bridges and Johnson and, you know, Dennis Smith in Simmons role.
Oh, that's fun.
Like, you know, maybe there's an interesting lineups there. So we'll see.
Yeah. I think you went with the right pick and I went with the hipster pick.
But we'll see. I like Watford. I like that I spotted Net Income tweeting about him for so long early in the season that like, or early in the off season that I was like, we're definitely going to get him. I had like barely heard of him. So, you know.
Like, why is he tweeting about this guy so much? Cool. Let's lot him into a two way.
Yeah. And then, you know, going through like my own internal, like, paces of like, why am I in Net Income's head? That's concerning to me. Might be time to log off.
He's almost like all of our grandfather.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. Well, hey, this is really fun. This was as fun to talk about as I was hoping it would be.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. And as predicted, we did not. We still stretched it into our usual length, which is exciting.
There was so much to talk about with the playoffs, though. We had to talk about how the whole East looked, improvements. Then we had to talk about the team, the players. You know, it's reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. It's good. All right. So tell the people where they can find us, Brett.
You can find us in Vermont and Texas. If you want to listen to us, you can find us on Breaker, Stitcher, Spotify, probably Apple Podcasts too.
The Stitcher app is going away. I heard that on different podcasts.
Oh no.
You can't find us there anymore.
Or you can only find us for a very limited amount of time. So get your Russell and Fro while it's hot.
Breaker, Uncle Cracker, Cracker Barrel, etc.
Yeah. Uncle Cracker. Wow, that's a good one.
No, no punchline. That we've made that joke before.
Yeah. Email us, Russell and Pro.
Cracks.com, dig, Up Rocks, GeoCities, Angel Fire.
Email us at GeoCities at Hotmail.com. They said you murked me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me. You never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you. Cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? Where you going? Can I come soon? I can't. I'ma be your man. Be my lady. And have my baby. Got my car. You got me crazy. Whatever you throw me, baby, could just take me. Cause I'm so taken. If you take it.
The Nets are back.
The Nets, are you kidding? They suck. But they're due. They certainly do.